Thank you, Mike. Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
I'm sounding really powerful this morning. It's great to see every one of you here this morning. Thank you so much for being here. You're welcome here wherever you are in life's journey, wherever you are emotionally, wherever you are on your spiritual path, you are welcome here. Let's start with music. Please join and rise in body or spirit and sing the first hymn, Morning Has Come, 1000, it's the first one in the Teal Hymnal, so there's no excuse for not finding it.
Good morning. My name is Michael Johnson, and I am this morning's lay worship leader. I welcome you to Wildflower Church, where we believe that all people have worth and dignity, whatever the color of their skin, the status of their citizenship, their gender expression or identity, their ability or economic status. We invite you to join us in our spiritual journey toward building an anti-racist, anti-oppressive society in which all voices are heard and all people are loved. I want to give special welcome to our first time and returning visitors. After the service, please join us for refreshments and conversation in the community room, which is to the left as you exit the sanctuary. We want to have a chance to get to know you and answer any questions you may have. And now, to light our chalice this morning, Ken Wills is our honorable volunteer. Thank you, Ken. If you know Ken, you know more about what that means. If you will join me in the chalice lighting words, with the kindling of this flame, we affirm our commitment to accept life's gifts with grace and gratitude and to use them to bless the world in the spirit of love. And now, if you will join me, please, in sharing today's unison reading by Unitarian Universalist minister Libby Stoddard, printed in your order of service. We have come into this room of hope, where our hearts and minds are open to the future. We have come into this room of justice, where we set aside our fear to name freely every oppression. We have come into this room of love, where we know that no lives are insignificant. We have come into this room of song, where we unite our voices in somber, beautiful melodies of life. And now is the moment where we take some time to get to know each other, especially to talk to the people sitting near you and the ones that you don't know so well. Please feel free to continue these conversations in the community room after the service.
What happy music. Good morning. I am Dee Adams and a member of the Board of Trustees of Wildflower. At Wildflower, we live our mission, and that is growing spiritually together, spreading love, justice, and joy. I want to share some of the ways you can get involved this week to grow spiritually and make a difference in the community. And boy, is it a busy week. First, growing spiritually together and having fun doing it. The Justice Team is focusing on mental health this quarter. This Thursday, August 9th, in the community room at 7, although there's a social time before that, Jeanette LaFontaine will facilitate an experiential workshop entitled Attention and Happiness. Can you imagine not wanting to go to that? And that's to support your mental well-being. Jeanette will engage you in developing tools for controlling your attention and improving your happiness. And our monthly family potluck and game night is this Friday, again in the community room, and that begins at 6 o'clock. Building community here is really key. You can also spread justice and joy by supporting the Austin area LGBTQ+ community. Wildflower is partnering with First UU and Live Oak to share a booth at the Pride Festival. That's going to be this Saturday, August 11th, at Festival Gardens. Volunteers to staff our booth would be appreciated, and Debbie White or Sheila Ray would be happy to have you. Want to stand up so people can see? If you'd like to be a part of that celebration, please see them. And of course, go to the festival and to the parade wearing your Wildflower t-shirts. Also, please see Edie Clark. Edie, do you want to stand? She really has information and process for us getting involved in the city council's deliberations around the living wage that we so hard fought for. This church was very involved in that, and it's in jeopardy. So please see Edie, and it's going to be this Thursday that city council vote's going to happen. So please see her. And more justice, and this time with love attached. As some of you may know, Guatemalan mom and child Hilda and Ivan Ramirez and El Salvadorian Alidio Gomez have taken sanctuary in two Austin churches, staying on the church grounds 24/7. That's been for almost a year. That's a really long process now. It used to be 2 to 3 months. This isolation is reaching a critical point for these three people, and they just need to be freed. As Brian says, this is something that really breaks your heart. At this juncture, the Austin Sanctuary Network asks us to sign a petition to urge Congressman Lloyd Doggett and Congressman Joaquin Castro to move ICE to use a discretion to grant these people stays of deportation. So it's time for these two congressmen to use their power to move ICE to justice and love for our neighbors. Debbie, Sheila, and Faye will have the petition in the community room during our fellowship gathering. Please consider taking this step. We do this with six other UU and liberal congregations, and so it's a really important step we're making. Thank you.
One additional announcement, the Pride festivities kick off today at 4 o'clock at the Jewish Community Center with a LGBTQ+ interfaith service at 4 o'clock at the Jewish Community Center. I will be there, and I hope to see some of you there too. I did post information in the Facebook page about it. I invite people of all age forward for the time for all ages. It's okay, you're fine there. Good morning, everyone. Thank you so much for being here. You all look so cool and relaxed, and here's me in my suit and tie and stole, and so hot. So you all look far more comfortable than I do. Yes.
My mom put lipstick on me.
Your mom put lipstick on you, and I see you've lost a tooth too. Yeah, you showed me that earlier. Well, it's lovely to have you all here. I'm going to be talking about hope today. And hope's kind of a complicated subject, but it's a very important topic for religious people because we really believe that a better world than we have now is possible, and that's one of the core beliefs of Unitarian Universalism and many other religions. Now, you probably have hopes in your own life, like you hope maybe you get a good teacher next year, a teacher that you like, I'm sure they're all good, but maybe a teacher that you like better than others. You hope that you're going to have some good friends. You hope you have good health. And you hope that school doesn't start too soon. You've still got a bit more summer left. Though I know some of you have already started school. Well, I want to give you an example from our history of someone who inspires me regarding hope. And she lived a long time ago. Her name was Olympia Brown, and she was born almost 200 years ago. And at the time she was born, you know, a lot of women weren't encouraged to get education, and education wasn't even open to them. But she really wanted to get educated, and her mum really encouraged her. And when she was at school, she had a chemistry teacher who was teaching her and told her that, you know, you don't really need to worry about understanding this. You just need to know enough to be able to be sensible in conversations because you're a woman. You don't really need to understand this. And she got kind of angry about this. And sometimes anger inspires us to hope. And she thought, well, that's not right. And she studied really hard and did really well in her chemistry. Who here likes chemistry? Only me. David, thank you. I like chemistry too. Nico, oh, there's lots of you like chemistry. You're just shy up here. Well, she loved chemistry and she did really well. But then as she got older, she decided that she was going to go to college, and she went to university, and that was unusual at the time, but her family was really encouraging of her. But then when she was at university, she was told that, well, you know, men have to learn things, memorize things by heart, but women, you don't need to, you have to read it. She thought, So she kind of prepared the script, and she had the script. Then she got up to do a final presentation, and she took out her script and then rolled it up and gave her speech from the heart. She had memorized it. So again, she found ways to get around the system. Well, then she decided she wanted to become a minister, and there was no ministers, not just Unitarian Universalist ministers, there was no women ministers in the whole of the United States back then. This was back in the 1860s. And she wanted to become a minister, so she went to seminary where they trained to be a minister. That's where Erin and I went to get trained. And we went to school and got studied, and she went to school and studied, and the president of the school said, well, you can join us and you can get educated, but you can't be a minister because women can't be ministers. But she decided she studied really hard and she became a minister too. So she never let anything stop her. There was all these obstacles. And then they thought, well, no one's going to employ you because of women, because no one wants a women minister. And so she applied, but she didn't apply as Olympia Brown. She applied as O. Brown. And so she showed up for the job interview and the preaching, and they thought, you can't be a minister, you're a woman. And she goes, yes, I can. Let me preach. And they thought, well, since you're here and we have no one else, we'll let you preach. So she got up and she gave a great sermon. And so they ended up hiring her. And, you know, this was all by the time she was like 23, 24, she had done all of this. But she didn't stop there. The other thing she thought was women should be entitled to vote, because at that time, women were not allowed to vote in elections, which seems kind of ridiculous to us now, but this was not that long ago that women weren't allowed to vote. So she campaigned for years and years. She wandered around rural Kansas campaigning for the right to vote. And she ended up giving up her job in the ministry and campaigned full time. And she was still alive in 1920. Even in 1918, when she was 80-odd years old, she protested the president during the First World War because he was supporting a war, but women still couldn't vote. And eventually in 1920, at the age of 87, she was able to vote. And she was one of the first of the early suffragettes, the women who campaigned for the right to vote, who ended up getting the vote and being able to vote. And guess what? When it came to vote, she was first in line to vote at the age of 87. And I look at someone like that, you know, some of the things, she did all these things by the time she was 23, you know, she'd become a minister, but it took another 60 years of her working and her hoping that she would get the right to vote, and she got it. So I think it's a great example. Sometimes these things happen quickly, and sometimes these happen a long time. And she was the first woman ever to be ordained and serve as a minister in North America. And she's a Universalist from our tradition. I think she's a great example of hope, how not only you can hope and you can dream, but you have to work towards that and not let anyone stop you when they tell you you can't do it. So thank you so much for listening. It's time for your religious education class now, and Miss Rebecca will be leading it today. And I wish I could join you because I hear it's really good.
We are met today to explore and celebrate hope. And hope is nested deeply in the values of this community. We know that enabling hope calls for time and heart and passion. It also calls for money. So I hope you will give this morning to the offering generously and in the spirit of hope. If you are visiting us for the first time, please let the basket pass, as your presence here is gift enough. The offering will now be given and gratefully received.
I was surprised there was no dancing. We allow dancing here, it's okay. You just don't want to see me dancing. But I'd like to thank Mike, Jason, Elke, and Ike for blessing us with their music this morning. One of the things we welcome in religious community is people to come as they are. It's an act of hope coming to religious community. And you come, some of us come with joy and celebration, and some of us come with hardship and suffering. And please know that they are all welcome here. We are now going to have a short time of joys and concerns for those of you who are carrying a great joy or a great concern. May come forward and drop a pebble into the bowl of water, and in one breath, tell us about where you are, what's on your heart, whether it be a great joy, whether it be a great concern. Because we often find those shared joys shared can amplify the joy and celebration in the community, and a concern shared can maybe unburden us just a little. We will now have joys and concerns, and please use the microphone.
This is for those in the world who are suffering, the Rohingya, the Yemeni, the Syrians, those in the Congo who have now had the new outbreak of Ebola, and especially for the children who are not back with their parents yet.
And I would like to share my joy that we are expecting a fifth grandchild in December. This is my oldest daughter, who's 42 years old, and they were not sure they could even still have children, but she and her husband are overjoyed, and as are we all, about this new little one coming to bring hope to the world.
Some of you know about this one already. I hope my neighbor who got evicted can find a permanent place to live, and if you know of a cheap place, maybe let me know after. Maybe I can let him know.
I would like to share a joy with the congregation of a beautiful gathering yesterday of the first annual People of the Global Majority UU Conference, and it was just a beautiful, healing, restorative gathering of people of the Global Majority from across four UU congregations and community organizations. And I just want to give my heartfelt thanks to Wildflower and the volunteers who helped support this endeavor.
I was reading an old journal as I was preparing for the Unitarian retreat, The Point, this summer. And 2 years ago, I first announced here that I was depressed. And my spirit has been lightened in the past week. It's often my best week of the year. And I wanted to let you know that. My mother, who recently joined the ancestors, was memorialized there after attending for 39 years. And I feel like I formally joined the elders.
So, my wife Sarah Duke wants me to express our great concern on one hand that she has posterior cortical atrophy, Alzheimer's, which is very rare, but also we've just found she's on a research drug, and they have realized that it actually slows the progression, probably the first drug to have any effect on Alzheimer's ever. Thank you.
I just finished my last semester of my last class of my master's program.
That's a joy, yeah?
This is a joy as well as a prayer of hope. Those of you who were here at my ordination in October may have met my friend Simone Barnes, who spoke shortly before the ordination. She was diagnosed with a pretty severe cancer. And so this weekend we celebrated the completion of her chemo and radiation treatments. So I hold a prayer for her healing. Thanks.
This is also a joy, but as you know, most of you know, I can't say these things without crying. So I'm just going to try anyway. As you know, I've had a year of horrible physical things, that just the worst of my life, not the least of which was kidney disease, chronic kidney disease, and metastatic prostate cancer. The joy is twofold. Number one, the bone scan indicate that this cancer is confined and is treatable. So that's one joy. The other joy is, thank you. You folks have been so supportive to me through all of this and have come to my side. It just is, it's been a part of my healing to have your love.
So my younger sister, who still lives in Maryland where we grew up, has been really sick lately since May. She said three surgeries. She's going to have a fourth in about a week. She's been in and out of the hospital. She has antibiotic-resistant infection, and so it's really difficult to be this far from her because we're pretty close.
Hi. I want to thank the people who are doing all the justice work in this church. I am almost anything but political, but I want to tell you that one time I had a very important event in my life. I invited Lloyd Doggett, the congressman. He came. He wrote me a personal thank you note. He said, "Thank you. It's always good to be with your constituencies." So I want to just say that there is a ripple effect if you get to be involved in the justice work here, and that Lloyd Doggett actually listens.
With Unitarian Universalists, there's always someone that wants to do it differently. I'll put one final pebble in for all those joys and concerns that remain in the sanctuary of our hearts. I invite you now to join me in the spirit of prayer. Spirit of life and abundant love. Spirit of this community present here, who through our presence make this a sacred time and a sacred place. We are thankful for all those who bring their full selves here, their joys and concerns, our hopes and fears, our dreams and our anxieties. We hope those who shared joys feel that their joy was celebrated and amplified here. And we also hope that those who shared concerns feel heard and perhaps their load lightened a little. For those with concerns, whether shared or which remain within themselves, we wish strength and comfort at this time and the days ahead. May all present feel more connected with each other through all that was shared. When we are struggling, our isolation from others can amplify our sadness and loneliness, perhaps nudging some of us closer to despair. May those of us with difficulties at this time find a way to overcome them, or perhaps just a way to cope and endure them for the moment. May all of us find strength, courage, and healing to guide us to find what is life-sustaining and life-affirming to each of us. Life can be both a wonderful, enriching journey and a difficult, troubled road. May each of us remember that our journey is elevated and troubles eased through a community where we can share our celebrations and struggles. A community that laughs and rejoices with us, and a community that cries and hurts with us. That cares about us at all times and reminds us that we are both lovable and loved. May all of us experience this at Wildflower Community. May we experience this and more. I invite you to join me in silence. Blessed be, and amen. Please rise in body or spirit for our second hymn, hymn 1012, When I Am Frightened, 1012.
I was born in the Promised Land, Southern California in the 50s. Life was to be good, and I could do and make and be anything I wanted. Exploration of the space was underway, and the sky was literally the limit. Hope and great prosperity surrounded me. My country had won the war, vanquishing evil in Europe and Asia. And while the rest of the world toiled to repair the vast destruction of that awful war, my country remained virtually untouched. And so it rose as the victor, as the hero, and as the most powerful nation on earth. And Southern California was the pinnacle of America's ascension for reasons too numerous to mention. Owing only to my place of birth, I was heir to that hope. My world was bright and shiny and new and full of energy and promise. You could see the USA in your Chevrolet. I lived in a brand new house. I attended brand new schools and churches. There was Disneyland and Bonanza and television dinners. Hollywood was just over the hill and the Pacific laid beyond. I lived in paradise and the streets were paved with hope. TV raised me as much as did my parents. And most of those TV people were good and kind and things worked out at the end of every show. The wicked ones always got what was coming to them. And at the end of every show, everyone was always hopeful and happy again. That same TV also showed me the darker side, maybe the realer side of my world. I saw children attacked by fire hoses in Birmingham. I saw people starving in India. I sat in breathless terror those long days of the Cuban Missile Crisis. But mostly that was all far away. I didn't know anybody who was hungry or who was poor or who was black. In my world, the only people of color were the so-called war brides from Japan and the brown-skinned men who labored in our yards. As the 60s dawned, things got even better. The Beatles and puberty showed up at almost exactly the same time. No more potent combination to fuel youthful optimism has yet been devised. So even as the problems of the world got realer to my growing mind, so did my belief that we could change the world. We could end war. We could eradicate poverty. We could overcome racism. Somehow we could spread the freedom and hope that I felt in every breath to all the oppressed people of the earth. I believed that the times they were a-changing. But then the losses mounted. They killed Martin. And they killed Bobby. And the war went on. And the cops and the army attacked the people in Chicago and Berkeley and Kent State. More and more, my hope was tainted with anger. The Beatles broke up. And Woodstock was overtaken by disco. And Watergate told a darker and truer story about how my country really works. But I clung to hope for a while, and so at first I chose political science as my first major in college. I thought it would prepare me for the coming revolution, and I was wrong. The more I knew, the less hope I could hold in my heart. By my 20s, my hope for the future, for my country, for humankind, for justice, for the planet, and for myself had dissolved into disillusion and anger. Mind you, my values remained intact. It was my sense of possibility that had declined. And with that decline, I descended into hedonism, apathy, and disengagement. I still voted and I still talked the talk, but only rarely did I put my money or my time or my body where my mouth was. And so I remained for a couple decades or more. I woke slowly from that slumber, beginning about 20 years ago, when Mary and I first attended a UU church. The lay leader that morning was a trans woman who told her story. Her friends, family, church, and employment had abandoned her on her journey into authenticity. But she had found a safe haven in that church. And the song following her remarks was "All You Need Is Love," the Beatles. As we drove home, I tearfully told Mary, if there's a place in that church for her, then by God, there's a place for us. And so my recovery of hope somehow began. I have not recovered completely. I don't have the starry-eyed optimism I once had, and frankly, I am not optimistic that the next couple of decades, or centuries rather, will not bring catastrophic changes to our civilization or even the end of our species. But I have come to believe that even if the future is dark and salvation unlikely, reducing suffering is possible and a good in and of itself. And that comes with and from hope. So my hope is now circumspect. I don't think people will overcome in-group and out-group oppression or greed or violence or short-sighted stupidity. Evolution welded those too deeply into our brains for that. But I do think I can help. We can help to make things better one moment at a time. And there I will put my time and my money and my body along with my mouth. And this place, this very place, this community, this church, all of you people, help me, give me that hope. With your passion and your persistence and your love. And so maybe, just maybe, the promise of that hope can be enough.
This is the story of a bird with no wings, certain that it can fly, sailing on love into the headwinds, waiting for things by and by. If only we were as strong as this bird, our spirit would never die. What do we name it? Hope is the right word. Hope is the bravest, most beautiful bird in the sky. Hope is a bird, flies higher than others, and keeps all our dreams alive. Free of all doubt, perfectly fearless, fed by its will to survive. Imagine ourselves becoming this bird. We can if we dare to try. See ourselves flying over the mountain. Hope is the bravest, most beautiful bird in the sky. Only hope can light the way. Only hope can heal the heart. Only hope can keep the clouds from hiding the moon and the stars. If only we were as strong as this bird, our spirits would never die. What do we name it? Only one word. Hope is the bravest, most beautiful bird. Hope is the bravest, most beautiful bird in the sky. Only hope, light the way. Only hope, heal the heart. Only hope keeps the clouds from hiding the moon and the stars. This was a story of a bird without wings and rose above everything, never once giving up hope.
Thank you. Okay.
I'd like to begin with a poem by Universalist Minister Gordon McKeeman. I stretch forth my hand, knowing not what I will touch. A tender spot, an open womb, a warm, pulsing life, fragile blossoms, rock, ice. I am tentative, trembling, wishing to avoid hurt, wanting to link my life with life. Lonely, I desire companions. Naked, I long for defenders. Lost, I want to find, to be found. Will I touch strangers or enemies or nothing? My hand is withdrawn, but still it touches my vulnerable skin, my furrowed brow, my empty pocket, my full heart. Do others reach, tremble, withdraw? Do they desire, long, seek? Are they lonely, fearful, lost? Will they grasp a tentative, trembling hand? I stretch forth my hand, knowing not what I shall touch, but hoping. Those are the words of Universalist Minister Gordon McKeeman. I was really intrigued listening to Michael's reflection, because his experience of hope, his trajectory that he laid out so eloquently, was almost the exact opposite of mine. But we ended up with the same conclusion. And I think it's more than we grew up 8,000 miles apart. I don't think that was the only reason. Because Michael talked about how there was so much media and living in California that there was so much external hope conveyed to him, or optimism might be a better word. When my experience, I grew up in a town suffering severe industrial hardship, much like many of the cities in the US in the Rust Belt. I saw poverty in my next door neighbors. I saw violence in my school. I saw people with no hope of employment. I saw people hungry. It was not a hopeful environment, but I grew up hopeful. And I look at, like, how was I? I mean, was I just one of those genetically predisposed hopeful people? And I don't think it was. I think it came from my family. My mom and dad and my community had hope for me. And it's hard, because I think what Michael ended up concluding was that community can give us hope. And for me, my hope was early on. And then the outside world that started off very bleak consistently improved. And I got my hope reinforced. I was the first generation of my family to go to college. And I remember talking to my uncle, or my great uncle as he was, who was a coal miner all his life, and saying to him, I'd like to go down the mine sometime in my first year of college. And he said, we did not send you to college for you to go down the mine. And I realized I had a responsibility to a community. I had hopes of a community, of a family placed on me. And that was a responsibility, but it was a blessed responsibility. And then my first year in college, I got really involved in the anti-apartheid movement. And it was really interesting, because the first campaign I really ever worked on was for them to basically remove financial support for South Africa and investment in South Africa. And within 3 months, it worked. We did diversify from South Africa, investing in South Africa. And I thought, this social justice work's easy. What's taken everyone so long? It only took me 3 months. The fact that those people have been working on it for 30 years may have been something to do with that. So I got that reinforced. And, you know, and even there was some comical stuff that happened in Glasgow around the anti-apartheid movement. We had a South African consulate in Glasgow, Scotland, where I grew up and where I went to university. They renamed the street the South African consulate was on to Nelson Mandela Place. So the South African consulate had to put Nelson Mandela Place as its address. This is when he was still in prison. So even the city council was supportive of this justice work, so it seemed kind of a hopeful time. And the economy improved slowly. And I went to college, and I was able to, get a decent job afterwards, so the economic circumstances changed. So for me, everything was kind of, my optimism grew rather than got thwarted, which was a bit like unlike Michael's experience. And then even, I remember watching an interview in the mid-80s, and it was about South Africa, and someone asked who the president of South Africa would be if everyone got the vote, and they said, Nelson Mandela. He had been in prison at that stage for 26 years. I remember thinking to myself, don't be ridiculous, he could never be president. Hindsight's an interesting thing. I realize, he came out of prison and he got released, and that was a hopeful time for those of us who had been involved in the anti-apartheid work. And he made a speech. I remember one of his first speeches he made after he came out of prison about reconciliation and how the need of bringing whites and blacks and East Indian people together. And it was such a hopeful speech. And I listened to that speech and said, you're right, he is going to be president. And he was. So there was all this hopeful time, and then in the early 90s, there was the collapse of the Soviet Union and communism, and things, the New World Order, remember that? It was still a hopeful time, so all my hope was getting reinforced during that time. And one thing, I loved Michael's quote about adolescence, puberty happening the same time as the Beatles. Mine happened with punk rock. What does that say about things? I didn't think we were that different in age. But. So things were very hopeful. There was an anger, but there was a channeled anger to change things, and things were changing for the positive in the world. And then I think where my hope got dashed was around 9/11 and the terrorism that arose. Now, my daughter was born in 2003, and she says her generation always, this country has always been at war. There's always been the threat of terrorism. And I think 9/11 dashed the hope for many of us, because there was so much hope with the economy before in the 90s. There was the economic collapse. There was the 9/11. There was a war in Afghanistan and Iraq. The number of terrorist attacks. And then there was a lot more hope during a certain president. And my hope has been declined over the last year and a half with our current president, where the mean-spiritedness and the cruelty that I see in much of our government policy, really questioning where my hope is. And yet, I'm not even sure I'm hopeful. I think I might be an optimist. And why? What are my sources of hope, and what are my sources of optimism? And one of my friends describes his daughter as eternal optimist. And he said, if she woke up on Christmas morning and her living room was full of horse manure, she'd conclude that she was getting a pony for Christmas. I'm not sure I'm that optimistic. And I struggle with much of liberal religion's optimism. I think we have a very optimistic view of human nature. And I think that's been called into question, I think, in a very valid way. You look at the tragedies of the 20th centuries, the war, the Holocaust, the Vietnam War, the Korean War, the terrorism, and just this inhumanity of one person to another, usually one man to others. And it's hard to be positive about human nature. Michael talked about the in-group, out-group dynamics, and that seems to be so ingrained in so much of humanity and so much of the source of so many of our problems. So I'm not sure I'm so much of an optimist, but I've got this view that I approach life with high hopes and low expectations, and I'm really disappointed. Because, you know, I've mentioned before, Narcotics Anonymous, they've got this idea that expectations are just premeditated resentments. Well, I think hope is post-meditated dreams. Hopes are post-meditated dreams. Because you look at all the great changes that have occurred in the world, it's because someone dreamed that there's a different possibility, such as Olympia Brown. She wanted an education. She wanted to become a minister. She wanted to get a women's vote, and she fought for it over the years. That started off at a dream and became a reality in her lifetime, and she was lucky because she was one of the few of the early suffragettes that was able to vote. Many of them never saw that day. So I do think hopes are premeditated dreams. So I ask each of you, what are your dreams right now for the future? And what dreams are you willing to act upon? I've mentioned many times to this congregation that I believe religion and religious community is about exploring what do you love and what breaks your heart. And I believe hope is the intersection of those two things. What breaks your heart and what do you love? You find the intersection of those, and I believe you're where your hopes and dreams are. The late Czech president, playwright, and democracy activist, Václav Havel, who was a prisoner under the communist regime in the Czech Republic, says this about hope. The kind of hope I often think about, especially in situations that are particularly hopeless, such as prison, I understand above all to be a state of mind, not a state of the world. Either we have hope within us or we don't. It is a dimension of the soul. Hope is a dimension of the soul. It's not essentially dependent on some observation of the world or estimate of the situation. Hope is not a prediction of the future. It's an orientation of the spirit, an orientation of the heart. It transcends the world that is immediately experienced and is anchored somewhere beyond its horizons. Hope, in this deep and powerful sense, is not the same as joy, that things are going well, or willingness to invest in enterprises that are obviously headed for success, but rather an ability to work for something because it is inherently good, not just because it stands a chance to succeed. Hope is definitely not the same thing as optimism. It's not the conviction that something will turn out well, but the certainty that something makes sense, regardless of how it turns out. Those are the words of Václav Havel. And what I take from that is hope is not some vague wish, but it's what engages our passions, our emotions, and what gives us a vision to work for something larger than ourselves. And hope is ultimately, what vision of the possible do we want to live by now? As I mentioned during Joys and Concerns, I think showing up at church is an act of hope. And I encourage us all to show up here, not just when we're feeling good, but when we're struggling. I often know that when people are struggling, church can often feel like the last place they want to go. Please, please, if you're struggling and if you know people are struggling, invite them. This is when we need community. This is when we need religious community. This is when we need to be connected to others. There's a wonderful story from a number of years ago from Palestine. There's a couple called Ishmael and Abla Kadib, and they lived in the Jenin refugee camp on the West Bank. And their 12-year-old son was shot and killed by the Israeli army. And the Israeli army, he had waving a toy gun that looked fairly realistic. The Israeli army apologized, and unrare for that region, there was no cause for revenge. Ahmed was taken to a local hospital where he died, and it was an Israeli hospital. And his parents made the decision to donate his organs. He donated his heart, his kidney, his liver, and lungs were transplanted to 6 Israelis who were often seen as the enemy by the Palestinians. And 4 of them were Jewish. That action by Ishmael and Abla, his parents, that's the act of hope, because there was great suffering and there was great anger. And the father, Ishmael, said that, yes, this was a kind act, an act of altruism, but it was an act of hope because he hoped by doing this that some Israelis would realize that Palestinians were human too. And that there's an example of how can we take our suffering, our grief, and our anger and use it to connect from one group to another, as Michael talked about, the in-group, out-group dynamic that's so entrenched in our society. There was an example of someone taking their suffering and for a moment trying to connect across that. And examples like that are what I believe can change the world and give me hope. And one of my biggest sources of hope, and this is going to sound perverse, is that when I look at the myriad of problems in our world and our struggles, is that most of them are created by human beings. Most of them are man-made, literally man-made. And that actually gives me hope, because if we created these problems, we as a species, as a human beings, should be able to change them. And perversely, that gives me hope. Because really, none of these problems are intangible. We have the capacity to feed everyone. We have the capacity to provide healthcare for folks. We have the capacity to provide education for people. Why aren't we doing it? Those problems are solvable. It's not a time to be hopeless. It's a time to be hopeful. We can solve those. It's not going to be easy. It will take centuries. But religious communities like this are, I think, on the brink of doing that. As we address anti-racism, as we address sexism, as we address homophobia, we are on the brink of transforming this community through that. And eventually, I believe, the world. So I am hopeful. That's my source of hope, because these problems can be solved. Bell Hooks, the activist, said, once you do away with the idea that people are fixed, static entities, then you see that people can change. And there is the hope. So I have this sacred hope that someday future generations will live in a world where loving and caring for one another is a primary guide. I invite each of us to commit our life, this time, our actions, to do our small part of sending the world towards that future where love is the law. This gives me hope. May our faith sustain us, may our hope inspire us, and our love guide us. I invite you to rise in body or spirit for our final hymn, Fire of Commitment. And I don't know what the number is. What's the number?
1028.
1028.
Thank you.
Remind everyone to join us for refreshments over in the community room. Please take the time to continue connecting. As we leave this place, may we take with us the fire of commitment, the spark of hope, the warmth of community with us the days ahead. May each of you find that thread of hope that you are going to pull on for the rest of your life to spin that world to a more loving, caring, and kind place. Go with love, go in love. Blessed be, and amen. Thank you, Mike.